I'm Anthony Walsh, and this is the Roadman Podcast, the show where we empower you with the tools to optimize your health, your happiness, and your longevity. Today on the show, we have the amazing Penny Mallory. Penny made history when she was the first woman to ever compete in the World Rally Car Championships, showcasing, yes, her skill, but also her tenacity in one of the most challenging sports on the planet. But Penny's talents extend far beyond cars and the driving seat. She's also a very highly sought after motivational speaker, television presenter, and author, sharing her insights on mental toughness, peak performance, and how to overcome obstacles and achieve your dreams. Here's a little taste of what awaits you today.
Quite often people face the challenge, go, well, I know I'm qualified to do it, but I don't think I can. So their confidence is low, although their skill level's quite high. And then there'll be another bunch of people who have a very low skill level, but massive confidence. Like, I totally know I can do this. And the confidence you have in your ability to do something will change the outcome. Lots of people make promises to themselves and break them regularly. I'm a bit like you. If I say I'm going to get up and run at 7, I will, because I don't like to let anyone down, including myself. When I got into driving, which is something I'd wanted to do since I was about 7 years old, I saw it on TV, sort of parked it in my mind, and then I suppose a moment of rock bottom and you just think, sort your life out, do something stupid, do something brilliant, but do something. And I did something brilliant. I took myself off to rally school. That day changed everything.
Penny, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Penny, I had this little bit of time this morning and I was having some introspective time with my journal and a coffee. And I was thinking back to the best advice I'd ever heard. And for somebody who's kind of stuck or somebody who's looking to start a new journey, and I can't remember where this came from, but I remember someone telling me to live your life like you're the author of a story. So right now, the story starts and I get to write this story, and maybe the hero is unemployed. Maybe the hero in the story is unhappy or overweight, but we get to write the hero's transition because it's our story. And that's a really powerful idea to my mind. So I'm kind of hoping today's conversation will be that catalyst for some people to start to write their story differently.
I hope so too.
So high expectations.
Okay.
No pressure. When I was growing up, my dad, he worked in the army, but we were always very working class. And to make some extra cash, he was always working on bikes. I don't know why he chose bikes, but he always had secondhand bikes around the house. He sprayed them all the exact same color. He'd like salvage parts from one bike or two shitty bikes and put them onto one bike, and then we'd sell them. And that was kind of my life growing up, was after school, going down to the shed at the end of the garden to fix up these bikes. So I actually think cycling got into my blood through some sort of osmosis process. It just seeped into my blood. Looking back to your early life, is there any similar type experiences that you feel driving got into your blood in that same way?
It's really interesting you say that, because on the surface, no, I had no contacts with motorsport. I didn't go karting as a kid. But actually, my dad was a bit like your dad in the sense that he loved tinkering with cars. And he used to have something in the garage, usually a pile of old rubbish. Even once for my birthday, he bought me a motorbike, but it wasn't for me at all. It was for him. And he was going to rebuild this motorbike for himself. I don't know why he thought that'd be a great present for me, but he was always had his hands in under a bonnet, you know, with spanners. And I don't know that he was that proficient at what he was doing, but he liked cars and he had a couple of nice cars briefly. And he would take us to banger racing and, you know, I can't even remember where or when, but in a weird way, through some form of osmosis, the car thing got under my skin. And I wouldn't say that I was crazy about cars or anything, but when I got the opportunity to drive, it all fell into place. And part of the reason that I was driving was to impress my dad. So that's, yeah, it did start at a very young age, but not in an obvious way.
What was your relationship with your dad like? What was early life like?
My family was all very dysfunctional, very weird. It all looked very nice and normal on the outside. On the inside, it just was weird as hell. And I knew it was weird. There was lots of stuff going on. And I absolutely hero worshipped my dad, but I was terrified of him. So that's a horrible dynamic because you want to get close to somebody, but you can't because they scare you. So it was a very weird thing. I just wanted to impress him my whole life. And I failed miserably on most occasions to impress him with anything. But hopefully at some point the driving made him proud. I don't know.
Do you still have a relationship with him? Or is he still alive?
No, he died. He disowned me when I was 14 and I didn't see him for 20 years. And then I sort of reconnected with him when I had children and then he died. So the 20 years that he was out of my life was the 20 years that I was driving to try and make him proud and win back his favour. And when he died and I cleared his house, I found newspaper cuttings in his desk drawer. So he had seen what I'd been doing, but he never told me that he was proud or anything like that. But I think he must have been, otherwise he wouldn't have cut the things out of the paper. So it was all a bit weird and massively dysfunctional.
That's tough. And I know listening to your story that 14... it seems to be one of these pivotal ages for you where you were almost thrust into becoming a woman at age 14 and you were the normal stuff that we expect a 14-year-old child to be doing. That wasn't your life at 14.
No, because I grew up way, way, way quicker than anybody should because my mum was really ill and she didn't really do much parenting. And that's very confusing for a child because everyone else's mum isn't like my mum. And so I grew up and grew fiercely independent so young. I would say like 7 or 8. I felt like I was an adult. And obviously I wasn't, but I felt grown up. So by 14, I really did feel grown up. And even looking back now, I kind of was. I was pretty streetwise. I'd worked the world out to a degree. I knew how to look after myself. I was incredibly resourceful, which of course you have to be. If you've got no one to lean on as a kid, you do learn to dig deep and get creative with life and how to manage. And yeah, which I'm so grateful for because I'm more resourceful than most people I know. Which it can be exhausting, of course, but it's quite a handy skill.
How did you wind up homeless?
So when I'd left at 14, I spent a year in a hostel attached to my school and then a year with my friend's family. And then I went to London. Of course, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any skills because I was a big underachiever at school. I literally just had nowhere to live. And I remember being sent to Euston Station, which at the time it's both still there. There's two towers, like sort of gatehouses outside Euston Station. And one of them was a charity called Home Alone. And so was it? No, it wasn't Home Alone. I can't remember what it was called. That was the name of a film. I can't remember. But anyway, it was a charity. It was one guy.
Macaulay Culkin running it now.
Yeah, exactly. maybe a bit of my life was a bit like that. But anyway, it was one guy behind a desk. And he said, there's one place in a hostel in Salisbury Road in North London. Here's some money for a ticket. They'll let you in. You can stay for a year, but you have to leave after a year. So I did, stayed there for a year, which was quite an interesting experience. And after a year, I still hadn't got anything. So I went to another homeless place, which was more like flats in a house, but everyone was crazy and stealing stuff and breaking doors down. And it was just horrendous. So that lasted, I don't know, 2.5 years or something. But I was sofa surfing, you know, just with a bag and staying with somebody for a week, some with somebody for a month. So I was really transient. And I couldn't tell you how many times I've moved house or moved myself and my luggage and my belongings, I would think 100 times. And so home is so important to me now because I love my house. I love where I live. And it means so much to me to have a home now.
I think identity is super important. And I talk about this maybe as a recurring theme through the podcast because a lot of athletes, the nature of high performance sport is, especially at the very, very top level where you're looking at international world-class level, you need to be so singularly focused on your craft to the exclusion of everything else. Mm-hmm. The public looking from the outside in, look at athletes and they think they're these well-balanced humans. But the reality is they've excluded almost everything and become single-focused. And that's what allows them to excel in sport. And on the back of that, they build an identity that I am an athlete. Now, that's problematic for life after sport because when you have a single identity and then that's taken away from you in retirement, you can be left as international runner David Gillick on the podcast and he woke up the day after retiring and looked in the mirror and he said, well, I'm nutting. Yesterday I was an athlete, today I'm nutting. That's really difficult. But also with circumstances like yours, where you're couch surfing, where you're homeless, where you've addiction, where you've dysfunctional family, it's quite easy to build a self-identity as I'm a loser. How do you get past that?
And that never happened because I didn't have time to reflect on what was happening to me. I was just getting on every day. I was just getting on and, you know, getting on with life. I never, ever thought about the situation I was in, if I'm honest. I was just like, shit, I haven't got anywhere to live. I'll stay here. And, you know, I could do a bit of waitressing there. And I was just, I was never sort of in a dark place particularly. I was just managing my life. But when, and you're so right, when I got into driving, which is something I'd wanted to do since I was about 7 years old, I saw it on TV, sort of parked it in my mind. And then, you know, I suppose a moment of rock bottom and you just think, sort your life out, do something stupid, do something brilliant, but do something. And I did something brilliant. I took myself off to rally school. That day changed everything for the rest of my life. And I became that single-minded, focused person that you're describing, which is not always the nicest person, because when you decide, I don't want balance in my life, I want to put everything into this one thing because nothing else matters, because this is the only thing that I'm interested in. I don't want particularly to socialize, see friends, go shopping like normal people. I don't want to do anything except immerse myself in this dream of becoming a rally champion. And so that's what I did. I was lucky that when my driving came to an end, I went into a TV show, a car show called Driven on Channel 4. So I didn't have that bereft feeling that I'd lost myself and my purpose and my mission and all that stuff, because I was suddenly thrown into TV, which was full on, and it sort of replaced my function in a way. I'm now a TV presenter and I talk about cars. So, but the driving thing never leaves you. Still with me. I still think about driving rally cars quite a lot, and I dream about it quite a lot. And I'm talking, it's 20 years ago. But it's a thing that did define me. And I'm not sure that you ever take that coat off, you know?
Roadmen, 60 grams of carbohydrates per hour. That's the minimum recommended intake for your rides. Most people don't know that. Focusing on nutrition and fueling, it can make or break your performance. But it can be really difficult to find a high-carb source that tastes great and isn't really tough on your digestive system. I've been cut out, if you know what I mean, a few times with GI stomach issues, and that's because of highly processed bars and gels. That's why I love Veloforte. These products never give me any gastro problems. That's because they're packed with real fruit, natural electrolytes, and they taste absolutely great. I love the chews, the Mela Apple Flavor Chew. It won the Great Taste Award. These chews are 100% natural. They're made with the purest electrolytes. They're a game changer. For me, it's something with the texture. It's a different texture from a gel, and it's so welcome at the later stages of a ride. I've got an amazing offer for you to go and check out for yourself, because I want you to test this product out. If you head over to veloforte.com and you use the code ROADMAN30 at checkout, you're going to get 30% off your order. That's ROADMAN30, and you're even welcome to share this code with your club or friends or teammates so they can check these out too. A few years ago, I saw a huge gap in the market for an app that was like a cycling coach, but in your pocket. I knew that AI was ultimately going to be the best coach in the world. And I spent about 2 years of my life trying to make this app happen. Unfortunately for me, it didn't happen. But ever since then, I've kept a really close eye on this space to see if anyone else could succeed where I failed. The Breakaway app caught my attention a couple of months ago because Christian Van de Velde, yep, the Christian Van de Velde who came fourth in the Tour de France, is one of the co-founders. And it seems that the Breakaway have created the ultimate cycling training companion, and they're bringing low-cost coaching to the masses. You'll know from listening to the podcast that my pet peeve is when cyclists head out the door with no plan, no goal, and just roll around without an objective. Don't be that guy! The Breakaway app looks at all your historic training data and it builds a plan around your strengths and weaknesses, so you're always going to have the perfect session. They also have integrations which I'm really excited about, Whoop and Oura Ring. The reason I've previously ditched my wearables is because the data just wasn't informing my training. No longer the case. head on over to roadmantrial.com and you can download their app for free. That's Roadman Trial, roadmantrial.com, and download the app for free. The link to this is in today's show notes. Can you remember the moment when you were starting your driving career and you're looking back on your background and the difficulties, the struggles, the tough times? Can you remember a moment where you thought to yourself, actually, do you know what? This isn't an obstacle. This is a superpower. This is a set of circumstances which no one else had, which is making me mentally tougher, which I'm cut from a different cloth than the rest of the people I'm competing against.
Well, again, you're... And everyone would assume that this was all conscious. It wasn't. It was only looking back on my driving that I can put all the pieces together. Because when I was in it, I was just, right, I need to get a sponsor, otherwise I can't do that rally. So, right, next sponsorship proposal, tell a few fibs, but, you know, big it up a bit. You know, and oh, shit, now I need a new crash helmet because I've dropped it and blah, blah, blah. And I was just one thing to the next thing. It never genuinely stopped. I never stopped to think, this is hard, or I need to be resourceful. It was never a conscious thing. I was just getting on with it. I was just immersed in that world. And it's only now, looking back, I can think, I can put all the pieces together and go, oh my God, that's why I did that. And honestly, in motorsport, it's impossible to for success. It's grains of sand on a beach. What I was able to do and make happen is crazy. But because I was so driven and so focused on achieving something, and obstacles to me were just really cool challenges. You know, if you want to do it, you're going to have to find this, or, you know, discover that, or break through that barrier, or whatever it was. And I was like, yeah, cool. I was quite excited by the challenges and the obstacles because I knew that I had the determination to smash through them. When most people didn't, they'd give up, and I wasn't going to give up. And I always found that quite exciting. So none of that was conscious. It was just how I operated.
Looking back now on analysing not just your career, but what you've learned from your career and kind of transposing that onto other people's careers, what do you think separates winners and losers?
No, I have no question of doubt in my mind is mental toughness, which is what I talk about. Your mental response to a situation will determine the outcome. So I tell you something, you or ask you something, or put a challenge in front of you, or something happens in your life, you will have a mental response to it, and that pretty much determines what's going to happen. So if you can develop mental toughness, you can take stuff in your stride. You're not going to fall apart every time something changes. You know, you're more resilient to pressure and stress. You start to get excited about challenges rather than threatened. So mental toughness, no question, it's what separates the people that win from the people that don't. That focus, that determination, the courage, the confidence, you know, all those words, all this stuff, you can't buy it, you can't go and get more of it, you develop it. But it's the one thing that makes all the difference. You know, quite often people faced with a challenge, go, well, I know I'm qualified to do it, but I don't think I can. So their confidence is low, although their skill level's quite high. And then there'll be another bunch of people who have a very low skill level, but massive confidence. Like, I totally know I can do this. And that's what the world is full of, everyone between those people and everything in between. So the confidence you have in your ability to do something will change the outcome.
Do you think it's the old question, I suppose, is nature versus nurture? And then off the back of that, you have all these kind of sayings that have sprung up, like show me a great man who's a son of a great man, meaning that we almost need some amount of adversity in our childhood to go on to any kind of greatness. People that are born into privilege typically find it difficult to eclipse the greatness of their parents' generation. Do you think greatness or mental toughness, well, I suppose greatness is not possible without mental toughness, but do you think mental toughness is a skill that it's possible to learn?
Without a shadow of a doubt, every human being can develop mental toughness every day. That's an absolute given. And whether or not mental toughness is nature or nurture is a question, you know, forever. Personally, I think my situation, my environment helped me to develop mental toughness. And the adversity that I experienced was incredibly useful to me And that is quite often the case with people who achieve things, because they have this, they sort of have a fire in their belly. They want to prove something or show the world something. And I remember meeting a racing driver years when I was driving, and he came from a really wealthy family. And I've never met anyone so lost in my life, because he didn't really have to work at anything because he was worth millions. And I remember feeling really sorry for him, because I had nothing, but I was so driven. He had everything, but nothing. So quite often that fight, that fire in your belly is enormously useful. And, you know, you will have spoken to so many people who have had, you know, weird growing up years, but it's sort of propelled them to really extraordinary levels of success. But it's not always the case. There's plenty of people. I think Jenson Button, Formula One driver, I think he had quite a privilege growing up, but was still very driven. So it's not always the case, but quite often it is.
One of the ways, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you create mental toughness. But for me, one of the things that's really worked is keeping promises to myself. So when you, and this is every day, this is not just for elite athletes, I found. It's like, if you set your alarm clock at 7 a.m. to get up because you say you're going to go for a 5K walk or run, and then the alarm clock goes off at 7 a.m. and you hit snooze, something happens there. It sows a narrative into your mind that I don't follow through on what I say I'm going to do. And the converse of that is, if I set my alarm and I say, okay, I'm going to go run at 7 o'clock, I get up and I execute, that's almost like a vote for the identity that I am an athlete. And we start casting these ballots all the way through our day with, we know what we should eat. We say we're going to eat healthy for dinner. Then we eat healthy for dinner. We cast another ballot. And if you cast enough ballots, I find, and you keep enough promises for the type of person you say you want to be, that causes an identity shift. And for me, that's been super powerful in transitioning from law to sport, now into podcast. It's like, well, what does a podcaster do? Well, like, he shows up on time for podcasts, he records podcasts, he publishes podcasts. There's a set of behaviors. So every time that I execute on one of these behaviors, it's like, okay, I'm casting a vote that now I am becoming a podcaster. That's been really important for me. Do you have any kind of a system or a process that somebody could deconstruct on how they could take your learnings from mental toughness and maybe apply it into their life?
It's so interesting what you say, because commitment is what you're describing, I think, which is one of the main components of mental toughness. So this is your ability to set a task and complete it. Lots of people set goals, don't they? Lots of people say, I'm going to do this, going to do that, and then they don't. They just do nothing about it. Lots of people make promises to themselves and break them regularly. I'm a bit like you. If I say I'm going to get up and run at 7, I will, because I don't like to let anyone down, including myself. So I'm quite a good friend in that sense, that, you know, we'll arrange to do something. And even if the time comes and I don't want to do it, I'll do it anyway, because I committed to do it. And I've always believed you can't have degrees of commitment. You're either into something or you're having a go. And I learned this very quickly in driving, in that I've got to give this everything I've got. There is no 99% here. I've got to give it everything, because it's the only way this is going to happen. Otherwise, you give yourself excuses, don't you, and get outs and options and alternatives, and it's just nonsense. So making that commitment will really filter out the people who are going to rise to the top, because any kind of high performance requires total commitment. Otherwise, it's just an okay performance, which is not, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's, you know, it's how most people operate. And of course, when you're 100% committed to something, you can be a complete pain in the ass. I get that too. So for most people, it doesn't really work for them. But a high performer enjoys commitment. They enjoy delivering on their promises to themselves, which is what you're describing.
I love what you said there about commitment's not 99%, because I think commitment is doing what you said you'd do long after the mood you said in has left you. Because commitment is when you're not motivated, it's getting out of bed. It's easy to say it on January 2nd, I'm going to get out of bed for your New Year resolution. It's doing it in the middle of February when the evenings are closing in, it's cold, it's wet, it's miserable. That idea of commitment can't be 99%, I love, because that means commitment now becomes a binary switch. You're either committed or you're not committed. It's not a continuum of I'm kind of committed.
This is exactly right. The word commitment suggests, or it explains, when you're all in. If you're not all in, then you're having a go. And most people don't like to be picked up on that. And it doesn't matter if you're all in or not, but if you are genuinely committed to doing something, you will be all in. And, you know, that's why people talk about, you know, work-life balance. And I'm always a bit like, I'm a bit torn on this one. If I've got 10 things going on and I give them all equal attention, then I'm not going to be brilliant at any of them, am I? So I've always been difficult, I suppose, in the sense that when I'm in, I'm in. And you can't change my mind and you can't distract me because I'm all in. So it's easy for me to make a promise to myself because I've made a decision, I've made a promise, I've made a commitment. I'm in.
Rodman, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal, ensuring I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for the takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating croissants and junk food, you know, just generally stuff that don't support my training goals. It's handy and it's nutritious, and it's over 22 grams of protein. Huel's perfect for athletes who don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for your session. Huel Ready to Drink has over 26 vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, they're all natural ingredients, stuff like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. And the best part, the flavors are amazing. 8 mouth-watering flavors. Iced coffee is in my backpack at the moment. You can get your hands on Huel Ready to Drink directly to your home just by going to huel.com/roadman. That's Huel, huel.com/roadman. I went to see Tony Robbins, the motivational speaker, and he had a brilliant story about this commitment. So he gave this, it's probably a fictitious fable, where a group of invaders are going to take this island back in, you know, Viking times. So they get into the boat and they sail across to the island, and the captain says to them, okay, we're committed. We're definitely going to take this island. And they're all like, yeah, we're definitely going to take it. Then they get to the far side and he says again, okay, we're definitely going to take this island. We're all committed. And he said, yeah, we're all committed. He said, okay, if we're all committed and we're not going back from the island, burn the boats. We're not going home. We're 100% committed. There's no way out. There's no excuse. There's no possibility of taking a different road. The boats are gone. And when I hear people saying committed, that's what the first question I ask myself, did you burn the boats?
Yeah. And that's, it's a big ask. Most people aren't really up for that. I don't think it's a comfortable place for most people. I love it. I feel quite comfortable. And if you've been an elite athlete, you'll totally get it. But it's not, it's easy to assume that everyone else thinks like us and they don't. Everyone's different. So, you know, you ask me to get up at 7 a.m., I'll have a very different mental response to it to my next door neighbor if you asked her to get up for a 7 o'clock run, because we're just all different. And you can get frustrated with people when they don't think like you. They don't operate like you, but it's not for everyone. You know, this all-in thing is quite a big deal. And most people, they don't like it. They want a bit of leeway.
For sure. I don't think high performance is for everyone. I think it's, you know, I always explain high performance as it happens in the shadows. And I don't think it is for everybody. But I also don't think that everyone doesn't need to be high performance. Everyone shouldn't strive for high performance. I think commitment is something we can take parts of it and apply it into other areas of our life. Like, you know, if we're balancing 2-3 different things, you know, the level of commitment it takes to be high performance, it's on, off. It's binary. And when it's on, it has to be your whole life. But there are other areas, like you can learn Spanish by, you know, going to a Spanish class once a week. You know, you don't need to move to Spain, leave your family, quit your job to learn Spanish.
And that's how most people operate. They do things, you know, at a relatively sensible pace. They dip in, dip out, because that suits most people. And that, there's nothing wrong with that.
In terms of building mental toughness, so commitment is one aspect of it. What do you think are the other components that if we were to deconstruct what it takes to be mentally tough, what are the other components of it?
Yeah, and there's four areas. They break down to another two, so there's eight in total, but I'll just keep it simple. So there's the sense of control you have of your life, or the extent to which you feel you have sufficient control to make this thing happen. Because generally, human beings, when they feel out of control, it's a horrible feeling and it's easier to walk away. You tend to commit, you tend to work a bit harder when you feel like you've got control of something. So you can develop the sense of control you have of your life, where it's going, writing the script of your life, like you described at the beginning. But there's also emotional control. So this is an area I'm not very good at. I reveal my emotions a bit too easily. I'm way too much of an open book, but emotions are contagious. So they can really affect our mental responses to situations. So there's control. Then there's challenge. That's your ability to see this massive challenge you're facing as an exciting opportunity rather than feeling threatened. So a lot in business, a lot of people, you know, everything's changing at just the most crazy pace, and businesses are restructuring and trying new things. And it's freaking everyone out that works in the organization, because they just, all these challenges is just too much stress, too much pressure. If you mentally tough people on the whole, and you will know this from cycling, you see a massive challenge and you start to get quite excited about what you could do with this, what you're going to learn from it. Even if it doesn't go your way, you're definitely going to learn something you didn't know before. So that's an important aspect. Then the commitment that we've talked about. And then finally, confidence. The confidence you have in your ability to do this thing. So if I start a project and I'm not entirely sure that I can do this, I'm going to have a very different outcome to if I have the confidence that I can smash it. It's inevitable. So having that confidence in your ability, but also confidence, the extent to which you're prepared to engage with other people. You said champions are made when no one is looking. The hard yards goes in the shadows. You can't achieve anything on your own. You cannot win a race without the support of your team. It's impossible. We need to engage with other people. We need to lean on them, and we need to support them, and we need to engage in a way that is, you know, everyone's got something different to offer to the party, and we need to open up to that. So your interpersonal confidence is critical, because we need each other.
I'm thinking of so many of the components of this, and I'm taking what you're saying and I'm personalizing it myself here for this new podcasting career that I found myself in. And, you know, commitment, I'm undoubtedly committed to it. I do feel an element of control that I know where I'm going. But it's the confidence part. How do you build the confidence? So for me, the goal, if the goal is to be the biggest podcast in the health and fitness space, how do you build the confidence that that is a possibility?
Well, I think, and again, it's this, there's always a sporting analogy here, but, you know, anything we do for the first time is hard. Anything we do for the 100th time, it's not as hard. You have to just keep doing stuff, and you have to keep showing yourself, reminding yourself where you've come from. So, you know, your first podcast will be a very different one to your 950th podcast. And you're laughing because you know that's true. You've learned so much.
Oh, so bad. I think I was recording it into my phone like this for episode number one. It was shocking.
So you won't have probably spent much time reflecting on it, but your confidence in you know, your lovely relaxed style, your interview technique is miles better than it probably was at the beginning. You've confidence in your ability to produce a really interesting podcast with your people that you're with your guests. So your confidence has grown without you really doing anything. You just keep doing it. And 950 times is obviously going, you know, 950 times of practice, you're going to be way better than after 10. So just continually reminding yourself where you've come from, and also that setting the goal that where you want this podcast to be. And it really helps if you've been involved in sport, because you break down, you know, all the little components that you need to tick off in order to reach that goal. So you're in a really good place. You've got all the basis, of course, you have to make it happen. But it's about being clear about what it is you're chasing in the first place, being open to that changing at some point, because everything changes in life, and then having the commitment to deliver and the confidence that you have all the skills that you need. And where you haven't got the skills, you'll go and find them, or you'll lean on someone else because they've got them where you haven't. So it applies personally, it applies professionally, it applies sporting, in every aspect of life. If you have those elements and you can develop each of them every day, it puts you in such a great place. But the important thing is to remember that everyone's different. So what works for you won't work for me. It won't, you know, you might have 10 friends and they all respond very differently to the same sort of challenge, or if they're all put under pressure, they'll all react differently. I spent most of my life thinking everyone thought like me and got really frustrated with people when they didn't. And it's taken me way too long to understand that that's because everyone is beautifully unique and it's unreasonable to expect everyone to think and behave like me.
That's fascinating. Penny, just to finish up and to change gears a little bit, to steal a motorsport analogy there, when you were in the car, I want to just get into kind of your role as ambassador for female sport. We have a campaign in Ireland here and it's called Can't See Me, Can't Be Me. And it's incredibly powerful because we've, from my mind, one of the best female sporting ambassadors in the world is from Ireland, Katie Taylor. Katie's world boxing champion.
I went to watch her at the Olympics.
She's a force of nature. But Katie defined a genre here. There was no female boxing before Katie Taylor. Katie Taylor fought basically like in drag, or whatever the opposite of drag is, as a male, pretending she was a boy fighting other boys until they said, "This is ridiculous. We know this is a charade. She's beaten all the guys. We need to create a female category." So Katie created female boxing. And she's such a hero over here. Oh, it's a brilliant, brilliant story. She's someone I'd love to have on the podcast, but she does very few interviews.
Yeah, I watched her at 2012 Olympics and I was gobsmacked. The whole thing was insane, but I didn't know she fought as a boy. That's so sweet. Bless her.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But I'm wondering, when you were in the car, did you ever... It's that force of you're an athlete. Park your gender for a second. You're an athlete and you have this drive to compete and a drive to win. Was there extra pressure of, you know, quote unquote, representing women that was at a point, you know, too much pressure and you wanted to be just left alone to drive your car?
Yeah. So you've just touched on so many things there. So first of all, I've never been one to bang the woman drum. I just want to compete as an equal, as a driver. I don't want special treatment. I don't want to stand out. I also had the problem, which was the only way for me to get big sponsorship, was to hype up the woman thing. So I was so uncomfortable about it because I really wanted to sink into the background and just compete. I hated the fact that I had to sort of bang the woman drum, the female thing, because I felt so deeply uncomfortable about it. I genuinely, motorsport, everyone assumes is male dominated, which it is, but it's also the most inclusive sport I've ever come across. When I was driving, there was a trans driver. There was a disabled driver who was quite a good friend of mine. There was black people. There was every diversity of thinking, attitude, skin color, gender, everything. Everyone was included. And so there was never really any need for me to make a song and dance about it. I was welcome. I had one incident in 12 years that was unpleasant, but that was just a personality. It wasn't the sport. The sport was amazingly welcoming and inclusive. I wanted to put my helmet on, get my head down and drive. And I wanted to be everyone out there. It was never, you know, I'm in the girls' side and what girls can I be? That was never the thing. It was probably what Katie would say if you interviewed her. It was just, she wanted to be every opponent, whatever gender they were. And I think it's, again, really easy to create barriers that sometimes aren't there. Dare I say that out loud? If you have the commitment, if you have some ability, some confidence, you'll get there. There are, of course, there are exceptions to what I'm saying where there really are some massive barriers. But and Eddie the Eagle was one of them. That was a classic, wasn't it? I mean, he was told no, 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 and he just smashed through everything. So, yeah, the woman thing is an uncomfortable conversation for me because I didn't really sign up for that stuff.
What advice would you give to a woman who's listening to the podcast who wants to break into a male-dominated sport or even a male-dominated industry?
Well, I'd take all of those assumptions out of it in the first place. It wouldn't be advice for a woman. It'd be advice for a person. And it would be advice for a sport that, you know, I wouldn't even, once you say something's male dominated, you just jump to lots of assumptions in your brain. And that's just not how I operate. You know, to me, it's a playing field that's open to everybody. So what are we going to do to get to the top of it? And so I suppose part of the advice would be, don't limit your options before you even start. You know,
Penny, this has been a blast. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.